listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Ewan Lowe.
And I'm Robin Whittaker.
Welcome. Let's talk about our readings. Yeah. Dive straight in. Our readings, we are in Easter 3, week 3 of Easter. And the readings we will discuss today are John chapter 21, verses 1 through to 19, Acts chapter 9, verses 1 through to 20, and then Revelation chapter 5, verses 11 to 14. So it's a triple header today.
Yep.
As all good things are. Yes. We've got to go by threes because we're good Christians.
Yep.
So and John chapter 21.
Yeah. So people might notice this feels almost like a bit of an addendum in that if the end of verse chapter 20 really does sound like a nice conclusion and then we get some more resurrection.
We're done here. Oh, but wait, there's more.
Yeah, there's more resurrection appearances.
It's the post-credit scenes of John chapter 21.
Yep. And in some ways this passage falls into two scenes, and I think preachers probably need to decide where they want to put their emphasis. We've got the first part is what I kind of call like discipleship 2.0. Mm-hmm. We're back by the Sea of Galilee. We've got some of the same characters like Nathaniel and the sons of Zebedee that are mentioned back in the beginning of John's gospel. Mm-hmm. And again, they're going fishing. So there's a sense that post-resurrection, I mean, we could psychologize this. They've gone back to what they know, perhaps not sure what to do, but they're not catching any fish.
Mm.
And we get this scene of abundance and miracle and Jesus appearing and eating with them. And then the second part is really that whole conversation, the three times, do you love me, with Simon Peter, which I think is functioning as a 2.0 of the betrayal in chapter 18. So it's a lot to try and preach on all of it, although you could, but I would probably pick one.
Mm. And so do you – so
which one would I pick?
Well, I guess contextually, so then you would almost say, you know, verses 1 to 8 are one pericope, if you like, and then verses 9 onwards, because you include the fire as part of the conversation with Peter?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's important. So, you know, in that first part, you've got all those classic kind of Johannine things, the miraculous catch, so the abundance, Jesus multiplying, you know, might make us think of the loaves and fishes story or the water to wine at Cana.
Well, it is bread and fish again later.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that Jesus eats with them could be a way of kind of like another kind of proof of his physical resurrection type story.
Almost certainly, right? This idea of a fully human Jesus who is able to eat.
A bodily, I do wonder if there's a joke in there. I love like verse 7. It's that, we've got this competition between the disciple Jesus loved, the beloved disciple and Peter, and it's the disciple Jesus loved who first recognizes and says, it's the Lord. Mm-hmm. But Peter, who was naked in the boat, puts on clothes jump in the water. I'm like,
what are you doing, mate?
Yeah, you're opposite of what? Like, why have you put on clothes to then jump in the water to go see Jesus? So it's kind of like this lovely little Peter just being like an enthusiastic puppy who's not thinking clearly or something.
Well, at least he wins the race this time.
He does. And he rushes off. Anyway,
And obviously, you know, lots to be made there. And I'm sure preachers will have heard themselves many sermons about the idea of, you know, listening to Jesus' instruction and how to catch fish and, you know, the symbolic nature of, you know, mission without Jesus, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
So these are all valid ways to approach the text. Did you want to unpack a bit more that second one?
Yeah, let's do that.
And what you were talking about?
So I really think this, we need a literary view of the gospel here. Peter had denied Jesus three times around an earlier charcoal fire. So the only time we get this language of charcoal fire is here and back in chapter 18. I think it's verse 18, but don't quote me on that. And around that fire, Peter would deny him. Around this fire now, it's in a sense it's a scene of restoration. And so three times he's asked, do you love me? And three times he says, yes, Lord, you know I love you. And he's commissioned to feed my sheep or shepherd my sheep. And the language for love changes and the language for sheep and feeding and tending changes. So there's a weird little dialogue that people have made a lot about. We can come back to that. Mm-hmm. But I think the main thing is, again, it's both restoration and a kind of a recommissioning. So theologically, in terms of the grace it models, is Peter, the one who denied Jesus so thoroughly, is fully restored into relationship with Jesus, but then also fully commissioned to go and do likewise to the rest of the followers. So that it's not like, oh, you've got to put, you know, your probationary license back on and earn your stripes again. It's full restoration. So I think you could play with that quite a lot. And again, modeling that kind of forgiveness that is central to all of these sort of post-resurrection proclamation. We're going to see that in the Acts reading too. One note to say here, if like me, you've probably heard sermons that have tried to get all technical about the different Greek words for love, so the agapeo and the phileo. Basically, scholars now agree, and if you look at John's gospel, these are just used interchangeably. So don't go and preach the sermon saying Jesus says, you know, do you love me unconditionally? And Peter says, yeah, I'll be your friend. Because, there are other places in John's gospel where Jesus describes the way God loves in this phileo friendship language, that God loves me and you love me in this way. And equally, he uses agapao for other things.
Purely platonic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
At all times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. None of this eros romantic love going on here. So I will put it a link, but Ian Paul on his Fizo blog has a very helpful little article about this, and basically comes to the same conclusion I do, that this is really a renewal and a chance at redemption for Peter. It's not about how much he loves, or like, don't get weighed down in those different Greek words. Would be my takeaway. Anything else you want to pick up on here?
No, not in particular in this instance, I would say. So maybe we can move on to the Acts reading.
Acts 9, yep. So Acts 9, and the lectionary gives you 1 to 6 and then in brackets 7 to 20. So obviously if you're going to preach on this, we're suggesting
do the whole thing.
1 to 20. The story continues, and if you only do 1 to 6, you get Saul Paul's little vision of the light, but actually the real story is what follows.
That's right. I mean, we were chatting just before this, and I actually think that this story, this pericope in particular, is about Ananias. It's not about Saul.
Yes. So tell me more why you think that's actually the focus here.
I mean, if you track the characters, think about Ananias' position here. He's basically being asked to bring a religious extremist into his house by God.
Yeah.
Not just that, a religious extremist who has been persecuting his people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, is very clearly willing to go to almost any lengths to you know, fulfill his own vision, if you like, or his what he wants to do. And so, you know, God says to Ananias, hey, mate, can you go and get this Saul fella?
Yep.
And Ananias goes, well, are you sure?
Yeah.
Essentially, like, do you know who this guy is? Like, you know, he's been persecuting us. Like, why would I do that?
Yeah, he uses language of evil. Do you know? You know, I know how much evil he's done.
That's right, and that's very, very challenging, because what Ananias is being called to do is to, I mean, from his point of view, is to bring a terrorist or a religious extremist into his house and look after him.
Yeah.
And I. You know, I would be very happy to say that if God asked me to do that, I think I would deeply struggle to be able to do something like that.
Yep. And to help him, and then also offer him the mercy and forgiveness that these Christians are going around preaching and being persecuted for. But it's kind of like having to put put that into action in the most confronting possible way.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and what's interesting is that later in Acts 22, you know, Paul, by this point, truly named Paul, you know, he recounts this instance, and he actually goes into more detail about what goes on, right? He talks a little bit about, you know, the conversation that he has with Ananias, and, you know, it seems like this is an incident that really, really affects him.
Yeah.
You know, that he is shaken and stirred and moved by the experience, not just by what God does to him, but what Ananias does for him as well, and the conversation that they have.
Yeah, so Ananias, I mean, I agree with you. I think so often we preach this as a kind of conversion of Paul story, and we'll come back to whether that's even the right word. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what it model and thinking of all these little stories we're reading in Acts as way of, you know, what Christian witness looks like post-resurrection, Ananias is the far more interesting character to play with in terms of this is what Christian witness looks like. And I'm just thinking of how important it is for so many people of faith that that first person or your first mentor or, you know, we often have these people who've really been instrumental in journeying with us and discipling us in faith. And Paul seems to give huge credit to Ananias as embodying the mercy he will then go on to preach, right, and extend to others.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to be able to see that struggle here.
Yes.
In that of Ananias going, are you really sure that this is a good idea?
That's right.
Dear God, do I have to do this?
I know. And as we were saying before, it reminds us a little bit of the Jonah story where, you know, absolutely. The reluctant prophet where God says, go do this. It's like, no, I really don't want to.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a deep challenge. I keep coming back to this. I go, imagine if there was someone in, you know, your community, and for some of you, this may be the case where you've had someone who has been on the outside throwing stones or, you know, attacking your community or you personally even.
Yeah. Or your family, like someone really close to you.
Absolutely. Yep. And then turns around one day, has a revelation of God's saving grace, or, you know, you're sent to be the person who delivers God's saving grace. Because I do think that this is part of it, that without Ananias, there is no Paul.
Yeah.
Right. It's a both and. Like, you know, it's Paul falling over, but it's also the Christian love that is exhibited to him in this moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it is Paul like seeing the light, being blinded by it, but actually without Ananias and the Christian community, he might never have moved beyond that.
That's right. Yeah.
And I mean, the consequences of Paul having this sort of epiphany, we might want to say, he sees this bright light and he's literally blinded, but then he's blind for 3 days and he also doesn't eat and drink. So symbolically, maybe Luke, the author of Acts, is, you know, this is modeling a kind of Jesus crucified. Mm-hmm. Paul will go on to talk a lot about being co-crucified with Christ. It's one of his favorite things. But there's a sense that he spends 3 days in the dark without nourishment. And it is the Christian community through Ananias who restores him. Then, of course, our scene ends in verse 20 with, you know, proclamation. So there's something, again, in 20 verses we get complete transformation, the movement from sort of darkness and scarcity into light and abundance, and then the ability to go and witness in the kind of Son of God.
And it's quite marked, actually, this part where it's like immediately this happened.
It's very, very dramatic.
That's right. It's very quick. It moves quickly. But, you know, how do you deal when someone who persecutes you turns around one day
and says, help me.
Helps me or you know, you're called to go to them. I can't even imagine being in that situation.
Yeah. No, and I mean, in a context like we are here in Australia, it's unlikely it would ever be this stark. But, of course, there are parts of the world where Christians are persecuted and sometimes mistreated by their neighbours of other faiths. And then if someone was to turn around and say, you know, you need to take this person in, they want to become part of the Christian community, it requires a huge amount of trust, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in God and in other humans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You mentioned earlier this question about where how do we call this? Is this a conversion? Like, do you want to unpack that a little bit?
Well, we've traditionally called it, right, Saul's conversion. And there's thinking here of a scholar called Beverly Gaventa who writes on Paul. She works in America. She really doesn't love that language because she said conversion is usually what we use to talk about moving from one faith to another or one religion to another. And this is the same God. You know, so Paul's a Jew. We know he was, he refers to himself in Galatians as being a very highly trained Jew, maybe in that Pharisaic tradition, highly educated man. You know, he thinks he's defending the faith. So there is a sense that it's the same God and it's the same faith and the same relationship with God, but he has this kind of aha, theological transformative moment. So which then almost becomes part of a calling, like where God's like, stop persecuting me.
Mm.
And so I think of this as maybe an epiphanic encounter.
Transformative epiphanic encounter.
In the same way we might think perhaps slightly less dramatically, but in our own journeys of faith, and preachers might think if they've got, you know, examples from their own life to share of moments where you've really shifted on something, right? You might have changed a theological position or really, you know, your understanding is deepened through a particular experience, you know.
Even if, you know, you grew up Christian
your
whole life and but didn't really take it seriously and one day you had an encounter, a transformative encounter.
That's right.
That led you into this.
Yep. And we wouldn't necessarily – I mean, in some churches we'd call that conversion, but I'm just wanting to not imply that, you know, Paul didn't know God at all.
Yeah.
He actually knew God and entirely thought he was doing the right thing. And, in fact, this is not the only transformative experience he'll have.
That's right.
And, you know, Acts is full of them with Paul and Peter as well with that vision of the food and what I've declared clean, don't call unclean.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there's lots of these moments of kind of revelation, if you like, where, you know, these early Christians, as they become, will have sort of insight into the way of God in a way that they haven't before.
And it's that beautiful thing of, you know, you track the trajectory of the disciples all the way through Acts.
Yep.
And it's not a, you know, they don't have all the answers straight away.
It's
actually quite a long journey.
Yes.
And they argue a lot about it.
Yeah, they're figuring it out.
That's right. And that always gives me hope as, you know, we know what churches are like. We're humans and we have arguments about things that sometimes when you look back 5 years later, that why did we argue about that? Or why did that matter? But, you know, it's all part of the journey. And, you know, we embark on our own distinct journeys of understanding, just like the disciples did.
Yeah.
And we don't get it all right either, and neither do they, so it's all good.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, yeah, so there's a whole sermon here on how we be more like Ananias, even acknowledging that that is difficult or something. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also just one last little observation, which I really love here, which, you know, it comes towards the end of the passage where you see Saul, this time. He is restored, jumps into the baptismal font straight away.
Yes.
Eats some food and then off he goes.
Yes.
I am declaring to everyone he is the Son of God. It's that fervor of the, well, I mean, we would say perhaps the new convert, even though as we've just said, he's not really a new convert.
No, but there's a sense. Yeah.
And I think that's always wonderful, but sometimes we don't really know what to do with that, do we?
No, we're not always good at knowing what to do with that in the church. We can be a bit nervous about such people.
That's right. That's right.
But, I mean, some of that is also, of course, just the narrative style of Acts where everything is super dramatic.
Super quick.
And, of course, because of the Holy Spirit. So, again, we've got, you know, the Holy Spirit is this very dynamic sort of active force of God in all of these scenes, bringing about such changes.
Yeah, very good. Shall we move on to Revelation?
Oh, we better.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion?
So Revelation 5:11-14, which is really, Ewan and I tend to think it's left out the best bit of chapter 5, but, you know, but we've really got a couple of hymns here.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I thought preachers could do if you're playing with Revelation has tons of hymns, and it is one of the ways the theology is declared very starkly. And, of course, we do that too. So one thing to play with is you could use these liturgically.
Yeah.
You could find some of the hymns that use similar language. You could do some unpacking of the hymns you sing in your churches and the kind of theology in them. There's all sorts of possibilities of playing with this creatively. But Ewan, tell us where we are in the tech. What's our context? Who's praising who and for what and why and what's going on here?
Well, I mean, John's been vacuumed up into heaven. He's seen, well, a lot's happened, right? He steps into this throne room, which looks remarkably in some instances like the emperor's throne room, but slightly different. So that's an interesting little thing he's playing with. And it seems that this is the microcosm of heaven, or the heavenly court, as many commentators would call it. And, you know, there's this scroll and you know, who's worthy to open the scroll? No one knows. Oh, who's worthy? No one's worthy. And then the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered, and he's going to do it. And then he sees not a lion. He sees a lamb.
Yep.
And then everyone falls over and worships. Yes. I shouldn't say falls over. They fall down, but, you know.
Yeah. They fall down in an act of bowing worship. Yep.
Yeah. So it's an incredible – I mean, this is very early on, you know. Depending on how you like to talk about Revelation, you know, this is the – this is really when we first step into the narrative. If you take verses 1 to 3 more as introductory, which, you know, I tend to do and I think a few others do, chapters 4 and 5 are when we start diving in. And, it's a dramatic entry point.
Yes, yeah, I agree. I think the main vision really starts in chapter 4 with John beaming up to heaven or being taken up in the spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, again, what he experiences mostly visually, so he sees all the stuff and he's told in this book to write what you see. So he's writing what he's seen in this sort of grand vision. It's worth too saying, so the lamb is one of the images for Jesus in Revelation. Yep. Not the only one. He's also the lion. Mm-hmm. He's also going to ride a horse. He's going to appear in many guises.
That's right.
But it's not a normal lamb.
No. This is a quite a weird one. I mean, verse 6, a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Very nice when Revelation takes the time to explain things to us.
Yes.
Because it doesn't always.
No, sometimes we don't know what to do with the symbols because they're not explained. So there's a sense that it's an all-seeing lamb, right?
Yes.
And then the seven horns are like total power. So it's
authority.
You know, there's huge debate, is this a little lamb, is it a ram? But either way, even if it's a little lamb, it's got seven total power horns and all-seeing gaze. So this is by no means a normal little lamb. But it's slaughtered yet standing. So again, we've got in this couple of – what are only a couple of words in Greek, a capturing of the death and resurrection of Jesus in now as kind of a symbolic way, I guess.
Yeah, and also that capturing of that now, not yet, you know, past, present, future sort of idea that we see all the way through Revelation, that the lamb can be both at once.
Yes.
Which is very, very interesting when you think about it.
Yep. So it would be worth us saying maybe, so who's worshipping here and the sort of content of the worship our bit?
Yes. Well, I thought it was very, very interesting that the worship, what we see throughout 5 and including what's in the lectionary but also before that, there's actually an expansion.
Yeah.
Right? Because the first hymn is sung, you know, the text implies that it's sung by the four living creatures and 24 elders.
That's in verse 9, the earlier one.
Yep, that's
yep,
right.
Yep, yep.
And then we have this uncountable number of angels and the living creatures and the elders. So, you know, we've expanded a little bit to include basically the heavenly court in verse 11. And then in verse 13, the third of these hymns, we have every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea.
Yeah, which is literally the entire universe for this author. Yep.
Yeah. And so you can, in your mind's eye, you can almost see this very rapid expansion, kind of from this small inner circle in the throne room.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, everything in the cosmos is praising and worshipping God.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, you're going from a soloist singing in one little church somewhere to the whole church singing something, to the entire universe singing something, you know. And we do get this expansion. It's quite remarkable. So we need to be attentive to who's doing the praising and that it is both humans, perhaps resurrected humans in this vision, the 24 elders, as well as these other creatures and angels. So that is also sort of cosmic in its scope in that it transcends just human beings and even creation. So for those who might like to think ecologically,
yes,
you know, you've got the whole of creation or all the creatures. So non-human creatures in the sea and on the earth as well.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we perhaps should talk about a little bit more in our preaching and in the way we go about talking about this text in particular, because if we do take Revelation seriously and we do believe that every creature, the cosmos, sings to honor God, then we're, you know, what's our responsibility as stewards for that?
Yeah.
To
definitely
protect and to maintain and yeah, it's a real challenge, I think, to every single one of us.
Yes, and to see ourselves as one with and part of rather than separate from.
Mm.
So one other thing I want to note is just in that last hymn that's both escalated in sort of scale, mm-hmm. but we get the one seated on the throne, which is how this author refers to God in mm-hmm. Revelation most of the time. So mm-hmm. Which I quite like. It sort of transcends gender or any even physical description. It's just the one seated on the throne who's in the previous vision is like bejeweled and shiny and covered in, you know.
Metallic.
yeah. So not just – don't imagine just an old white man with a white beard. This is not that. Mm. this is beyond that. But and the Lamb are both worshipped with this blessing and honour and glory forever and ever. So it's eternal in time. We've got like this massive scope and we've got eternal time.
Mm.
And we've got Christologically Jesus being worshipped with equal worship, which yep. is quite remarkable that early on Christians did this, right? And Jewish Christians,
mm-hmm.
You know, declared Jesus as equally worship, equally worthy, sorry, of worship as the God that they'd been worshipping.
And if we remember that the Lamb has seven eyes, which represent the seven spirits as well, mm-hmm. that's actually then a Trinitarian
yes.
kind of complete, you know.
Who's part of, yeah, thing. The Lamb's body and comes yeah. from the Lamb. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a shame that the Spirit kind of gets subsumed into the Lamb here, but
yep.
yeah, it still warrants a mention earlier on in chapter 5. And, you know, the author of Revelation is very clear to make it, to say, well, the spirit still floats around. Seven spirits in Revelation's instance, but still floating around.
Yeah, so I feel like there's so much this week. I feel for preachers they're going to have to pick something because we've got, you know, and maybe we pick up all of them for our people in various ways in worship, but, you know, you've got here a scene of really worship as a response to the crucifixion and resurrection as the primary response. And, of course, that is always the response of the church is that we first worship.
Yeah.
But then we've got Ananias, I think, modelling for us what Christian forgiveness and discipleship even to enemies.
Yeah, self-sacrificial discipleship.
Yep. And that wonderful scene of the restoration of Peter and the sort of recall of all the disciples. So
yeah. I mean, many opportunities for preachers, depending on your community and yeah, where everyone's at, to be able to find something that really speaks to them.
Yep. Thanks.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.